ما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين خاتم النبيين سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وشفيع نفوسنا وطبيب ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد.
ثم الصلاة والسلام على أهل البيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المنتجبين المكرمين، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من الأولين والآخرين إلى قيام يوم الدين. أما بعد، we begin in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise, all thanks is for Him and for Him alone. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, Assalamu alaikum jami'an wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So before we start, again, we have some announcements in the beginning. Are there any people sitting in that hallway? Everything's okay now, inshallah? Okay. So I know it's a little packed tonight, which is, alhamdulillah, a good thing. This should just mean that, one, that if people are going to talk and use their phones, it's going to be easier to point you out now that everybody's sitting a little bit closer. And the second thing is that now that there's a lot more of us, the salawat should be a lot louder. And remember that we have to end them with wa'ad jin farajuhum. So let's try it. A loud salawat. So let's continue the lecture now, inshallah. We've been going through the Usuluddin. And for what purpose? So that through the Usuluddin, if we went through the proofs, we would get yaqeen in them. We would become certain that Islam is the true religion and that there is no other true faith. And after doing that, then inshallah we would be able to have iman. We'd have true faith in our religion. And with iman, then inshallah, hopefully we'd have the willpower and energy to stop disobeying Allah and to move forward as Shia Ali. Inshallah. So we started with Tawheed, we went through the proofs of the unity, the singularity of Allah, and the existence of Allah. We went through His justice, we proved that anything from Allah is always good, there's no such thing as evil from Allah. We then stopped at prophethood. First thing we did was, we established that Allah has to send a prophet, for many different reasons, but we use the reasons of justice and His mercy. That in His justice, He has to send us a prophet, so that we don't end up in chaos, trying to figure out what His rules are, so that we can obey Him. Now, yesterday, we had also identified that one quality of a prophet has to be isma. He has to be infallible. Because if he were to make mistakes, if the prophet was to sin, then we would follow him in those sins, and we'd follow him in those mistakes. And if we did that, then Allah couldn't hold us accountable. But as Allah says, He'll hold us accountable for every single thing because the prophets have shown us the way. So where do we move from there? So we know that there's prophets. We know that they're infallible. Now, let's just say we didn't live in this time. You know, our time is the time of Imamah. You know, we are in the time of Imam al-Asr, ajallahu ta'ala hu farajahu shafi'. But what if we had lived in the time of the prophets? Would we have been able to identify who they were? Alhamdulillah. Now back then, whenever we read Quranic verses and stories about how people denied the prophets, you know, sometimes we get a little arrogant, you know, we're like, how could these guys deny them? You know, it's so simple to see a prophet. But how would we, if we were facing that scenario, if we weren't in the time after the Khatam al-Nabiyyin, if we were in the time before that, would we have been able to figure out this person's a prophet if he came and, you know, told us that? So let's figure out, first of all, is there a way to definitively prove, absolutely, that a person is a prophet? Or is it a shaky proof? Well, again, the first thing that we have to understand, as we proved before, is that in Allah's justice, He has to show us His way. Otherwise, He can't hold us accountable for anything. So what does that mean? That He has to be able to provide all of His messengers some sort of proof, something unique that no other person could do. That if a person claims that, I'm coming from Allah, I'm bringing you His message, this is my proof that I'm coming from Allah. Because there have been people, even in our time, there are people who come and claim, I'm a prophet of God. It's, you know, even in Muslim countries they do this sometimes. But come and say, well, I'm the next prophet. Khatam al-Nabiyyin, there's no such thing as the last prophet. There's more that came afterward, and I'm the next one. So we have to make sure we can identify this. So again, the first point is to make sure that we understand that there is a 100% definitive way to know that Allah will send a proof for this prophet so that we can say this is definitely from God and from nothing else. This is not just some person who's a little crazy. So there's two ways we can look at this. We can look at what the person's saying, and we can look at what the person brings outwardly. And I'll explain a little bit more about that, inshallah. So, what he says, the content of his words. Now, in order to do that, we need a different kind of prophet before we can listen to or follow this prophet that is a person or a man in front of us. What do I mean? Well, we have a hadith from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And he says, Al-Aql Rasulul Haq. And what does that mean? Al-Aql, which is intellect, or your brain power, is like the prophet of truth. So what does that mean? It's that you should be able, meaning Allah has provided us with the barometer, or the tool necessary, that if someone comes and gives us a message, we should be able to say that this person's on the right, or this person's on the wrong. For example, if a person walks in the room right now, and he says, well, I mean, let's say, again, we're in the time before the last prophet. So he comes and says, well, I'm a prophet. He'll say, okay, if you're a prophet, what's your message? Well, my message is that we should slaughter all little children who misbehave. So right away, our Aql tells us this doesn't make any sense. So something that kind of breaks our common sense, which doesn't make any sense, and that everybody can agree on, we know that this person can't be from Allah because of what he's saying. But we can't always follow this. Why? Because many a time, our Aql isn't working properly. We think it is, but our Aql isn't always sound. So this discussion we're probably not going to go into tonight because it's going to take a lot more than, you know, 30 minutes to go through. So what we want to focus on is the outer stuff that the prophets bring. And what is that? That's mu'jiza. Which is? What's a mu'jiza? So what do we mean by miracle? Well, before that, let me give you an example of something that might happen in our daily lives. If you send another salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
So, many of you guys have gotten this advice, you know, the younger children who, you know, are in grade school. You know, some of you might get picked up from school, you know, and your parents will come and pick you up, right? Now, let's say a person is there instead of your parents, and they say, well, your mom and dad sent me to pick you up. Would you go with this person?
No.
Why not?
Because he can rob you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he could rob you, that's true. He's a stranger, right? Okay, but what if he says, well, I know your mom and dad, you know, we're good friends, you've probably never met me before. How are you going to be able to figure out if he's if your mom and dad sent him or not?
I don't know.
What kind of question?
Is it a monster in a coat? Look
how weird she has or whatever.
Go ahead.
What color skin is, and what's their name?
Well, could somebody figure that out just from looking at them? They could just see your parents and then come and say, well, I know what color their hair is, I know what color their skin is. Anybody can find that out, right? You just go on Facebook and they'll see a picture of your mom and dad. I don't know why parents are on Facebook anyway, but... Keep an eye on your children, I know. Yeah. Okay, but what if it's been a while? Let's say you're waiting for a very, very long time, and now you're like, well, maybe this guy might be telling the truth. How would you be able to tell for certain that he's telling the truth or not?
Call your parents.
You can't get hold of him.
I'm sure that guy has a cell phone
number. Okay, I'll give you the answer now, because we'll be here all day. But what people say is that you should set up some sort of security password with your parents. That, okay, if we can't make it for some reason, and we send somebody else, then they're going to know our secret password. Like, I'm trying to think. Give me an example of a password we can use.
Facebook.
No. Huh? 786? Okay, that works. 786. So now the person comes, the stranger comes, and you ask him, okay, if you're from you come from my parents, they sent you, what's the password? If they can't tell you, then you know that they're not from your parents, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah.
Yeah. What if the person already knew the password?
Yeah, beat the guy. At least just plain lucky.
He's lucky. Okay. The whole point, before we get into a big discussion now, The whole point is that if you have this secure password set up that only you and your parents would know, then there's no way of this stranger being able to, you know, fake being your friend or being friend with your parents. So Allah has set up something like this with his prophets. This is what a mu'jiza is. It's something that is only allowable for someone who has that gift, that permission from Allah, nobody else. So it's something that's possible, like we can see it happening, but there's no way we can train ourselves to do it, there's no way that we can imagine ourselves doing it, there's no way scientifically that we would be able to do it. Something you can think about, but you can't really, you know, can never get to it. You need some other special power for it. So let's go through some of these, for example. Let's go through first Nabi Musa alayhi salam. What was his, in his time, what was his mu'jiza?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
That's not a good answer. Well, one thing you have to remember also is that when the Prophet has a miracle, when Allah gives him an ability, it has to meet with the timing and the environment of the people right now. Like, let's say a person came and said that right now that, oh, I'm a prophet, look, I'll show you fire, and then he lit a fire with a lighter. You'd say, all right, no, that's not a miracle, anybody can do that. So he has to have a miracle which outdoes everything that we know.
Like a magician.
Like a magician, exactly. You got the answer right, you didn't even know. So, in Nabi Musa alayhi salam's time, magicians were the VIPs of the time, I guess is the best way to put it. So they're the ones everybody looked towards. Yeah. Exactly. This is the gift that Allah provided Nabi Musa alayhi salam. When him and his brother Aaron or Harun alayhi salam, when they approached the Pharaoh, Pharaoh said, "Okay, if you're really from God, I'm going to call my magicians to show you that your magic doesn't work." So the magicians came, they created some snakes with some illusions or magic or whatever it was, and then Nabi Musa alayhi salam, by the power of Allah through his mu'jiza, threw his staff down. It turns into a snake, and then what?
Eats other snakes.
So now there's no way of anybody else, you know, being tricked. Except for those who have a faulty aqal. The brain's not working, or their heart is closed. See, the mu'jiza is set up so that the experts of the time can recognize that this person is something extraordinary. He doesn't come like everybody else can. He doesn't have a power that we all have. He's something beyond us. So this is why the magicians were the ones who recognized that this person who threw a staff down, turned it into a snake, and had that snake eat our fake tricks, this person has to be from God. There's no other explanation. This is why the magicians immediately said, "We believe in the God of Musa," alayhi salam, and they immediately became Muslim. But Fir'aun, unfortunately, didn't. Why? Because the mu'jiza can't affect somebody whose heart is closed, whose mind is closed. So that's why the first thing we have to realize, and we'll get into a deeper discussion about this when we start talking about imamah. Because when we get into imamah, that's something that we have to deal with in our time. Because what if a random person comes, he's got a turban on his head, he's got a cloak, and he says, "I'm the 12th imam, you guys got to follow me." How are we going to know if he's the real imam or not? We have to know what the experts of our time say, what will be his miracles, and we have to know what the other imam said about his coming. But again, inshallah, we'll get to those in, if we have time, in future discussions. So this was the gift that Nabi Musa alayhi salam had from Allah. So now we'll go into the gift of Nabi Isa alayhi salam, Prophet Jesus. So what was his gift? Or what were the experts of his time? I'm hearing whispers, but I can't make it out too far away. I'm guessing somebody said medicine or doctors. I'll assume that. Okay, well, that's what it was. So medicine, doctors were the experts of the time. So whoever could heal, they were given, like, you know, a special, again, VIP status. So Nabi Isa alayhi salam had these gifts that doctors couldn't fix. For example, he would cure the blind, he would cure people who had leprosy, which I don't think any of you have ever heard of, but then it's like a skin disease that if you saw it, you would know what it was. He also brought people back from the dead. So again, people can come back from the dead, but there's no way medical science can really do it. Now imagine, again, our time. Imagine somebody came and, let's say, you know, did something and then a person got up. We'd say, no, people can wake up from comas all the time. So that mu'jiza for Nabi Isa alayhi salam wouldn't work for us. So you see that every time has something specific. Now, what about our last prophet's time, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam? So what was his miracle? And what were the people of his time? Who were the experts then? You all know the miracle, right? What's in the Prophet Muhammad bring? Somebody say fire? Quran. Everyone knows. Somebody knows. They're just all shy. That's okay. Somebody said Quran. And that's right. But what is that miracle of the Quran? What exactly? Why is it so miraculous? Now, it's tough for us to understand because the Quran we have is, I mean, if you guys are reading it, it's just Arabic words that maybe we do or don't know if we've studied Arabic. Or we're reading an English translation which sounds like Shakespeare wrote it, which doesn't make much sense to us either. But for those in the time of the Prophet, the Jahiliyyah Arabs, the most important people of that time were poets, or people who had an understanding of Arabic grammar. And if I even, I mean, I'm not a person that can even go into it. You know, I've been studying for Arabic for maybe 4 years, and I have no idea what ba, ta, I mean, it's a deep, deep language. And it takes people sometimes 10, 20 years just to understand simple little meanings of why a letter is drawn a certain way, or why a dot is here and not on top. So, you know, Arabic is a scientific language, it's a poetic language, it's a mathematical language. You know, there's so much beauty into it, and unfortunately, many of us have forgotten to actually study the language. We learn how to read it, but we forget to go that. We need to know what it means. But this is something that we left to our scholars. But anyway, the miracle of the time had to work with the experts of that time. And since the experts dealt with the Arabic language, for example, every year they'd have this annual poetry competition. There's some word in Arabic, I don't remember what it was. But they would come out, you know, they have like this platform, it's almost like a freestyle battle. They all get up on top, and they would say their best poetry. And they'd come down, and then somebody else would get up, and they'd say their best poetry. And people would just do this over and over and over again. And the rich people of the time, the wealthy ones, if they like the poetry, they just toss money at them. You know, I mean, in certain cultures, I think we still do that now, unfortunately. But this was the way that the people acted. If somebody knew how to manipulate words and make something sound flowery and nice, people just loved it because they could take the words and flip them around in a certain way, and it just sounded really, really pleasant. It sounded like, you know, it had that, it lit up your heart. So when the Prophet Muhammad came, he brought the Quran, which was an Arabic miracle. It was a poetic miracle. It was an Arabic grammar miracle. Everything that came in there had some sort of special ability. And inshallah, because we're probably going to run short, I don't want to start the discussion. I'll probably go into tomorrow. What we'll do is, we'll see if we can go through some of the miracles of the Quran. Now, going into the Arabic poetry and the literature might not make sense because, again, I can't even call myself an amateur of Arabic grammar. So what we'll try to do is look at some of the other miracles of the Quran, which are the scientific miracles, which are the historical miracles. Things that we today can use and show to people of other faiths and say, look, for example, the Quran mentions so-and-so scientific thing, or it mentions this thing about the Milky Way, or it mentions this thing about childbirth. And inshallah, we'll get to that tomorrow night. But the whole purpose of tonight was just to give us an idea that there is an absolute way for parents, or sorry, for prophets to be identified as a messenger of God, as a representative of God. And the only way to do that is through two ways. One is if they bring a miracle, and a miracle that only the experts of the time can identify. Or it's through their message that somebody identifies that this person is speaking the truth. And a way we can see this is that in the time of the Prophet also, there were Jews and Christians who were there. And because they heard what the Prophet was saying, just from his words alone, just from the message of truth, they said this can only come from a Prophet. This is only the sign of a Prophet. So this is why they accepted it without having to see any miracles at all. But inshallah, we're going to end this part of our discussion from Muslim for Mu'min today, and we'll inshallah continue with a deeper understanding, and we're going to delve into the miracle of the Quran tomorrow night, inshallah. So now we're going to move just to a few issues of fiqh, inshallah. If you can send Allah to Allah. It's getting hot in here.
Yeah.
How do you think I feel sitting up here, huh? Okay. So there was a question that was, or an issue that was brought up yesterday that a brother was kind enough to bring to my attention. So I went in, did the research again, and I went to correct it. I think the explanation that was given wasn't the best explanation. So I just want to take a few minutes just to explain that out. So there's something as far as najasat and something being mutta najis and ainul najis is concerned. There's this domino effect that's discussed in fiqh. So let me read the question and the answer given by two marajih, Sayyid Sistani and Sayyid Khamenei. May Allah protect them and protect their lives. And then inshallah we'll explain it. So from the question and answer of Sayyid Khamenei, Hafiz al-Lahadeh, he says, when somebody asks him, does something which comes into contact with a najis object become najis? And of course the answer is yes. And then he continues the question. If it becomes najis, does this continue to apply to every subsequent contact, or is it limited just to the initial ones? So his answer here is, up to three subsequent contacts in its najasa is confirmed. And from the fourth contact onwards, tahara is most likely, and then this is where he differs from Sayyid Sistani, though it's better as ihtiyat mustahab to abstain from it. So again, I'm going to read through both of their rulings first, and then I'll explain it. And then the question on question answer from Sayyid Sistani, Hafidhullah Alayh, is where does the domino effect of mutanajis items stop when it's no longer wet? So the answer is, the first mutanajis item would make the item that it comes into contact with impure. That's one. The second mutanajis item would make the item that it comes into contact with impure. That's two. But the third mutanajis can no longer make other items impure, irrespective of whether it's wet or dry. And I think when I had read this myself, this is where I got a little confused, because it's speaking from the point of view of mutanajis, not the actual najasa. So let me explain this now, inshallah. So if you remember yesterday, I was using this weird example of washing a pig. So just completely forget that. Nobody's going to be washing a pig anymore. So imagine that you get a cut in your hand. So now your hand is najis, right? Because of blood. So now, let's say somehow that najis, you touch the other part of your hand. So now that najasat of blood moves over to your other hand. So now this is the first mutta najis thing. So that's number one. Now let's say somehow it wipes on your shirt. That's now the second mutta najis thing. Now let's say for some reason your friend grabs the shirt by accident, and now his hand becomes mutta najis. That's number three. From this point onward, your friend's hand, he can no longer make anything else najis, from the point of view of what these questions and answers said. Now again, according to both of them, you're okay, you know, that third one won't make anything else najis. But according to Sayyid Khamenei, he says that as ihtiyat mustahab, it's better that you treat everything, no matter how far you go along the line, treat it as najis just in case. So again, we should take that line of precaution. No matter how many, you know, domino effects you go and something, you know, taking najasat and moving it along, just make sure that you clean yourself, inshallah, to make sure that you're okay. Is there any questions about that? Any confusion at all? It makes sense? Yes? I see some head nod. That's good. Alhamdulillah. Okay. So today, we want to say a few things about everybody's favorite thing, food. So we're going to go through just some recommended acts and some makruh acts. So let's see if you guys can name a couple of the recommended acts first. What's mustahab in eating? Go ahead.
Eating salt, like a pinch of salt.
Okay, that's good. What else?
40 times?
4 times.
4 times? 40 what?
40 or 20, okay. A lot, chewing your food a lot, that's good, yeah. What else, anybody else know? No, that's it, okay. We got two. All right, well, let me just go through them then. Yeah.
Eating salt before?
Yeah, I think the brother said that. Okay. That's it? All right. So, let's try to go through, let's say that food is put in front of us. Let's try to say, like, we'll go through a timeline of us about to eat, and let's see how we can do every mustahab act according to the maraji, everything possible. So, before we even start, what do you think the first thing should be? Bismillah's there, but even before that. Wash your hands. That's all. I mean, you could say bismillah before washing your hands, like as you're supposed to, right? Okay, so wash your hands before eating. Great. So then you sit down to eat, and as the brother said, you take a little bit of salt. But of course, we have to say bismillah before the salt, right? Actually, you know, when I'm with my nieces, you know, I try to get them to do all these mustahabah. So I was with them, they're 6 and 8. So, you know, whenever I sit down, I'm trying to teach them all these things. So, you know, the food's in front of me, I take my salt, and I put it in my hand, you know, I eat it, and they see me, they're like, you know, why are you doing that? I'm like, oh, it's mustahab. Like, oh, okay. And then I say bismillah, and then I start eating. So my youngest comes to me, I think you should say bismillah before you take the salt, because salt is food too. So make sure you say bismillah before you take the salt, according to my 6-year-old niece. So again, we're washing our hands, we're saying bismillah, we'll have some salt. Okay, now we're ready to eat. Now what do we do? Well, that's kind of a vague question. Okay, we have a choice. You can go knife, you can go fork, you can go spork, you can go spoon, you can go hand, right hand, left hand, you can go your feet. How do you want to eat?
Ew.
How are we going to eat?
It's just sport.
Sport? I love sports, but that's not almost the hub. Yeah. Which hand? Right or left?
Right.
Right, okay. Why don't you do it with your left hand?
Because, you know,
yeah, because stuff happens in the bathroom, exactly. Exactly. Okay, so we're eating with our right hands now. And as the sister correctly said, we should take small bites and chew our food well. 40, 20, just chew it a lot, that's all. And make sure you're taking small bites, you know, don't just grab it and like shove the food in your mouth. Even if it tastes good. Okay. Now, let's say the food that we got was fruit. Obviously, I think even if we didn't know this, most people washed their fruit before, right? So something we were probably already aware of. But just to give you an extra bit of halal, it is mustahab to wash your fruit before eating them. And one other thing, a small note about fruit, is that according to some of our scholars, fruit is recommended in the middle of the day, not necessarily for breakfast, and not in the evening. So the recommendations for food are that we have two meals a day, one early in the day and one early in the evening. And if we do happen to get hungry in between, they say have a little bit of fruit here and there, and that's it. But anyway, let's keep going. So now let's say you're with your family or you're at a dinner or something like that, and there's like a whole long table of food. So which food should you take? Let's say you have some bread in front of you, and then there's some rice over here, there's chicken on this side, and all the way down there is...
rice.
I already said rice. Okay, a different kind of rice is back there. All right. Sorry. Brown rice for the health guys, and white rice over here. Chinese rice. All right. So which food can you take? What? Rather, which food should you take? What's in front of you? I heard somebody whispering again. Okay, yeah. What's right in front of you is best what to take. Now, if you really, really want that good chicken that's sitting in the corner, ask somebody to pass it. That's the best akhlaq you can do for that. So, also... Now this is something that I've noticed that in certain cultures, they actually flip this around. Who should be the first one to eat, and who should be the last one to eat? If you're with a bunch of people, let's say you're hosting a dinner. Yeah. Uh-oh.
First, the youngest one, then the oldest
last. Yeah, because you're young, that's why you're saying that. No. First the Mamanas eat, and then everybody else eats. Yeah. No. Nobody knows? Who eats first, the guest or the host?
Yes.
Okay. Hold on. Wait. If you think it's guest, say salawat.
Salawat.
Okay. If you think it's host, say salawat. Allah says the truth is always in the minority, isn't it? It's the host who's supposed to start.
Yes!
Yeah. Again, like I said, certain cultures, for some reason, they're always like, no, you start, you're the guest. But actually, if you think about it, if you're at a party, halal party, whatever, you're at a nice halal dinner with your friends, then if you're the first one to start and you're the guest, you're going to feel like, all right, everybody is looking at me like I'm a pig. You know, I have to be the first one to start. That's why the host wants to be the one who takes the pig quality on themselves, right? So that nobody will say anything to them. And this is also why they're the last ones to eat too. So that there's not this one person sitting in the corner finishing his last bite so that, you know, everybody makes fun of him. The host should be the first one to eat and the last one to eat. So let's remember that, inshallah. Next time you're at somebody's house, make sure, yeah.
So when you're done with your food, you just sit there and wait until the host is done?
Well, there's more than that. There's actually, everybody should try to finish at the same time too. I mean, there's a lot of rules to go through. I can only go through a few of them tonight. But if I went through every single one, you know, you'd be hungry by the time I was done and you'd forget all the rules and you'd go and eat anyway. So that was some of the mustahab acts. Now, let's talk about something that's makruh. Any guesses? I'm a little scared to ask some people here, but... Okay, go ahead. Eating shrimp? No way, I love shrimp. No way, shrimp is 100% halal. 100%. You eat it? Yeah, of course. You should. Oh. I'm not saying you should, but it's good. Okay, well, shrimp is halal. There's no problem with shrimp. Anybody else know anything makruh about eating? No, okay. Well, this could be an obvious one, but maybe it's not that obvious to some of us. Eating when you're already full is makruh. Meaning you're already like, oh, this food is good, I'm done. But let me have a little bit more. Now you're stepping into what's makruh. And again, they say the same thing, eating too much. So, the one thing we should try to practice for all of us, adults and kids, is typically we're used to piling our plate as much as we can first. What we should try to get in the habit of doing is, let's say, you know, we're like we get food over here. While we're piling that food on, try going like one big spoonful less. And just take that. And if you still have some room left, go back and take half of what you normally would. Try to end so that you're still hungry, just a little bit. And see if you can work your way down from that.
That's what I did.
The Prophet has told us that you should eat only when you're hungry, and you should stop eating when you're hungry. And I know that's tough for us because we're used to eating all the time and eating till we're about to explode. But it can't be like that. It's makruh. It's not good. And if I had time, I'd go into some of the effects of eating too much. Imam Ali alayhi salam has told us that the people who eat too much, their thinking is not correct. So your brain doesn't function properly when you eat too much. That's why you're all sluggish when you're full and you don't know what to do except pass out. So, the other thing is looking at others, somebody else's faces while you're eating. This is also a makruh thing. Because obviously somebody's trying to eat and they might be a little, you know, self-conscious, a little paranoid about the way they eat. You know, maybe they chew, like, they go like 5 bites here and they switch over to this side, do 5 bites. Everybody has their weird habits. So you don't want to point that out and look at them while they're doing that. So just eat, look at your own food and eat it quietly. One thing that, and from my, I've seen a lot of people also do is eat food that's very, very hot. Because they're either really, really hungry or the food is really, really good. And if it's hot, it's also makruh to blow on the food before eating. You should have the patience to sit there and let the food, you know, cool off for a little bit. We also have something that says cutting bread with a knife is makruh. I'm just reading what's here. All right, I don't know. That's what it says. You can rip it. It feels more manly to do that. And also, another bread rule is putting bread under a plate of food. I don't know. I guess people might put it on top to cool it or do something like that. I don't know. But that's something else that we don't want to do. And one more thing about food regarding fruit is throwing away fruit before you eat all of it.
Yes.
It's makruh to do that. You can't finish it, put it aside and have some of it later. Or chop it up in, you know, in pieces and take some of it or split it with somebody else. Alright, so that was with food. Now let's go quickly into recommended and makruh acts with water. Or drinking. Actually, no, this will be specifically water. So especially since we're discussing and we're talking about the tragedy of Karbala, this is something that has to stay in our minds all the time because of the importance of water in Karbala. And especially since tonight, the seventh night of Muharram, is when that water was officially cut off and they blocked everything off. So whenever we approach water, we have to have a sense of humility in us. That although we're living in, you know, a beautiful first world country where everything gets, it comes to us and, you know, we have no accountability for it sometimes, and we don't think twice. Like we had mentioned the other day, we leave the faucet on when we're making wudu and we're just wasting and wasting and wasting, while other people in other countries are dying just to have a little bit on their tongue. So with drinking water, we have to have the same exact respect for it. So, again, just like we have with food, Bismillah should be said before we drink water. Another thing we should also remember is, one is while we're drinking this water, we should be remembering Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his family. Remember the thirst that they had to go through. So one thing that we should try to get in the habit of is sending your salawat or sending salams to the Imam, to his family, to the shuhada. Also, it's recommended that we ask Allah to remove his mercy from those who killed the family of the Imam, the family of the Prophet. And you can see, you know, for example, you could say, Allahumma la'an qatalat al-Husayn wa awladihi wa ashabihi. May Allah remove his mercy from the people who killed Husayn, the people who killed his family, and those who were his companions. And this is while we're about to drink the water. Also, while you're drinking it, it's said to be drinking in 3 small sips, almost like you're drinking it from a straw. And after you're finished drinking, saying Alhamdulillah. Now, in the daytime and in the nighttime, there's 2 separate rulings about how you should be drinking the water. In the daytime, you should be in what position? Sitting or standing?
Standing.
And then obviously, at night, you are?
Sitting.
Okay, good. And just like with food, drinking too much water is makruh. And there's one other, there's two other things that are makruh. One is drinking water with the left hand. So just like food, the left hand is, it's not, it's makruh. It's a disgusted act in the eyes of Allah to do. And the other thing is drinking water after eating greasy food. Anybody have any idea why this might be makruh? Or one reason might be why it might be makruh? Yeah.
I'm just guessing, I guess. Mm-hmm. That is so
You getting help? Okay. So what happens if you have, let's say, like some oil, and you just pour water on top of it? Will it ever mix?
Yes.
Because you might accidentally spill some grease in it, and then it won't taste so good.
No, that's definitely true. Water and grease doesn't taste good. That's a good idea. But the other thing is that water and oil don't mix well at all. So when you have that oil in your stomach from some of the food that we eat, and that water gets poured on top of it, your stomach is in this bad state. And I'm not, gastroenterologist or whatever it's called. I'm not one of those stomach doctors. I don't know the official term. But, you can ask them, and they'll say that it screws up the digestive process. So you'll have some stomach problems. And obviously, you don't want stomach problems. So I don't like drinking soda, but whenever there's soda there and there's greasy food, this is my excuse to now go drink soda or juice or something else. So this is just some things that we should try to keep in mind while eating and drinking. Any questions, confusions, issues about that? Is that one issue? I know there's a lot to go through, but if you can take anything from... Oh, sorry, you got a question? No? Tell haram to eat what? Hot Cheetos? Oh, no way. I don't know if I should say this on camera. Don't say it. I'll tell you afterwards. Is that all right? Okay. So, yeah, we'll talk about the Cheetos thing afterwards. It's not a good idea, because I'll start ruining everybody's lives that way. So, again, these are just a few things we could go through. In the books of Akhlaq, there's many, many other things that we could discuss, but these are just a few things. And the main thing is that, again, we want to understand that although the month of Ramadan is the only time where we really have to officially practice fasting, we should try and keep that sort of habit, in the respect of fasting in any day. Meaning, don't eat like a pig every day. Try to keep yourself hungry once in a while. Try to eat a little bit less. Try to drink a little bit less. And you'll see that it's going to start changing your mind. Literally, it'll start affecting the way that you think. It'll start improving your memory, your speech, all these different things. So inshallah, that's something we can keep in mind. And now, inshallah, we're going to move on to the history, and then we'll end with the masjid, inshallah, if you can send Allah salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
So, as we had said, tonight is the seventh night of Muharram. And the significance of this night is that this is officially when they say the water was cut off in a way that they had lined up all the soldiers before. Now, before they differ on whether they say, water was really, it wasn't allowed for them to get, but there's some sort of supply that they said that the imams had from before the trip. So there was some water, some food available, but obviously they didn't have, jugs and jugs full. So, Ibn Ziyad, Ma'amtullah alayhi, sends a letter to Umar bin Sa'd, and he tells him that, tell your soldiers, create a full barrier at the Euphrates River to make sure that there's absolutely no access for anybody except our own soldiers to get water. So, after doing this, one of the soldiers, who was very arrogant and unfortunately of, one of these inhuman, barbarous types of people who thought they were Muslim, who thought they were defending Islam, but they were on the side of the wrong. And like we had said before, sometimes when your heart is shut off, when your heart is dark from sin, when your mind is closed and not working properly, you can come to some weird conclusions. I mean, these people thought it was okay to deny the family of the Prophet, to deny women and children water. This is what they thought was correct. So they cut off the water, and this one soldier, he comes and he shouts from the middle of the battlefield, trying to antagonize and to annoy the Imam and his companions. And he says, "Oh, Hussein, you'll no longer see any water like this color. The color of this blue sky." He's just trying to, kind of enrage the Imam and trying to make him feel bad. So he says, "I swear to Allah, you won't taste even a single drop of it, and you're gonna die. We're gonna make sure you die from thirst." And so the Imam replied, "Ya Allah," he didn't reply to him, he just made his dua. This is the akhlaq of the Imam. "Ya Allah, make him die from thirst and make sure that he never has any of your blessings." And how did this play out? The way that our history tells us is that this individual, it was later said that he was given some disease later. And this disease gave him this thirst that he had to drink water all the time. But because of the nature of disease, he actually died from overhydration. He had too much water. So this is exactly what the Imam said was going to happen. And as we know, the Imam's du'as are answered right away. So, inshallah, last night, we went to the tragedy, we went to the Messiah of the daughter of the sons of Bibi Zainab alayhi salam, Mona Muhammad. And we had seen that, you know, even children as young as 12 and 13 had this, you know, this strength, this tenacity, this love for the Imam, love for Islam, love for Allah. So much so that they were willing to give their lives up for the Imam. Now, these are 12-year-olds, they're 13-year-olds. So imagine that. You know, we have a lot of young individuals who are in the crowd tonight. And for you parents who are trying to raise your children, remember that it's never too young to give them the true message of the Ahlul Bayt. If the Imam's family can have 12 and 13-year-olds go out to battle, then why can't we have our sons have that kind of yaqeen? Let's not delay their true upbringing as a Shia of Ali. So tonight, we want to pay our respects to the son of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, known as Al-Qasim ibn Hassan. So, Qasim, again, was around the same age as Anu Muhammad. He was only about 14-year-old. Some say he was, again, about the same age as Anu Muhammad, maybe 13 or 12 at the least. So, Qasim, with his mother, had accompanied the Imam in Medina. So they had left with him together, and they had been with him with the whole trip. So this whole time, they both knew, both Qasim and both his mother knew that the reason that he was there was to seek martyrdom. They knew he was going to die there. But there was still that little bit of, I don't want to say doubt, but you know that even if you know you're about to go do something, sometimes there's that little bit of gap before you go out and do it. You have that little bit of shakiness, that emotionality before you go and do something really big. So now we turn our attention to the day of Karbala on the 10th, on the Ashura, when the army is beginning to mount their attacks against the Imam and his family. So the mother of Qasim calls him into her tent. And a lot of the soldiers now have gone out and started fighting each other. So this is in the middle of the battle. So she says to her son, "Oh Qasim, my son, do you know why I called you? I want to remind you about your duty towards your uncle Hassan. I want to tell you something about the love and affection Hassan, your father, had for his brother Hassan." Now, remember something else, brothers and sisters. Qasim was only 3 years old when his father, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, died. So he really didn't get to know his father. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam took over as his father. So keep this in mind as you hear the words of the mother of Qasim, as you hear the words of Qasim, and as you hear the words of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So his mother continues. The two of them, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, were so much devoted to each other that they were always thinking and acting in unison. The slightest pain suffered by one was instantaneously felt by the other as if they were twins. With the unique love your father had for Hussein, I can imagine how he would have felt today. He would have been the first to sacrifice his life for his beloved younger brother. And then she stopped for a few seconds, and she lowered her voice a little bit. And she said, I'm sure he wanted you to fight for him on this day. My child, when he passed away, you were too young to understand life. And she began to get choked up. And then she started to recite what her husband, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, told her. And he had said, on his deathbed, this was the last wasiyah. This is what he had told me. He had said, "O mother of Qasim, I entrust you. I give you my children. I give them to God and I give them to Hassan. When Qasim grows up, you tell him that my dying desire was that he should stand by Hassan through thick and thin. And I can see the clouds of treachery gathering against Hussein. A day may come when he may need the unflinching devotion and sacrifice of his near and dear ones. Though I will not live to see that day, as my last wish, I want you to prepare Qasim for that battle from childhood." And then her voice started to break up. And so she started to feel that pain, that sadness that a mother feels. She said, "My Qasim, since that day your father breathed his last breath, Hussein has looked after you as his own son, and he has treated you on all occasions better than his own children. You know how he has fulfilled your every wish, so that you may not miss the love and affection of your father. Now it's your turn to show that you can repay the debt of gratitude by laying down your life for him before any of his sons go out to battle. Now is your chance to pay back the love and affection. Show the enemies that you are from the house of Ali. Show them that you're from the house of Hassan. Show them that you are a lover of Allah, a lover of Hussein. And show them that you, a 14-year-old, a young boy, can wield the sword in defense of truth." And then he affectionately hugged his mother. And he had said, Oh, my dearest mother, I don't know how I can thank you for what you said to me just now. My love for my Uncle Hussein, you know what my love is for him. And from my childhood, I haven't known what a father's love means. But I am certain that even my father, if he was alive, would not have been so kind as Hussein was to me. He's not allowed me to feel for even a moment that I was an orphan. And thanks to him, in our house, every wish has been his command. How is it possible for me, the son of Hassan, to be oblivious of my obligations to him? For me, death would be far better than life without him and my dear uncle Abbas and my cousins. And Qasim's mother felt happy to hear this, that this, my 14-year-old son, this is the type of brave reply that he gives. But then, of course, that painful thought passed through her mind again, and then she again remembered and realized that this is the last chance she'll have to speak to her son. Because as he goes out to battle, there won't be any return. He'll go as shaheed. So this child, who she had put all her love, all her devotion, all her hopes in, she tried to hold back the tears, but how much can a mother hold back? The mothers in this crowd, they know. You can't hold back your tears for your children. Qasim went to ask the Imam's permission now to die in the battlefield. But every time he asked the Imam, the same reply came. It said, "My dear child, how can I permit you to go when I know for certain that death awaits you? I know that death awaits those who go out." He says, "Your father, my beloved brother Hassan, had entrusted you to me to take care of you. This is what he told me on his deathbed. And my heart trembles at the very thought of sending you into the jaws of death." And now Qasim's heart has been shattered. His hopes and dreams was to sacrifice his life for the love of Hussein. But now Hussein has not given him permission. What is he going to do? So with tears in his eyes, he stood there. And he tried to get the permission from Hussein. But every time he had said, "I can't let you go out." And now he doesn't know what to do. And at that same time, he saw Han and Muhammad asking for permission. And they were denied as well. And they had complained to their mother Zainab. And then Zainab had asked on their behalf. And he had saw that they got permission from Zainab. So he took the same idea. And he went running to his mother. And he had told his mother what had happened. And when his mother saw Qasim so bitter, so rejected, she burst out into tears. She tried to control herself, but how could she control herself? When she knew that he could not get permission for what he was destined to do. So her first reaction was to go over and beg the Imam, to implore him, as the widow of her brother, to seek permission for Qasim. But then she remembered her husband's last words to her before he passed away. And the Imam Hassan alayhi salam, had told her that Qasim, a time might come when you would find yourself in despair, when you'd need something. And when she remembered that, he told Qasim that there was a letter that was left for you by your father. So she pulled out, and there was two letters. One was addressed for Qasim, one was addressed for Imam Hussein. So now he anxiously just ripped open this letter to see what was inside, what was this last gift from his father. And then he read it aloud for his mother to hear. So Imam Hassan alayhi salam had written to it, "My child, Ya Bunayya, when you read this letter, I will have been dead. When you read it, you'll find yourself torn with the conflict between your desire to do your duty and to fulfill your obligations and to demonstrate your love and your affection for your uncle Hussein and his love and affection for you, compelling him to hold you back from battle. My Qasim, my dear Qasim, I have provided for you this letter to arm you so that Hussein has no argument. You can give this letter to Hussein so that he may grant you your heart's desire. This is as much as I could say for the occasion. I wish I could say more, but I can't. So you'll find that the time separating us is not very long. Soon, my child, you'll hurry to me and you'll meet me in paradise. And I'll welcome you with open arms." So when he had finished reading the letter, of course he was choked with emotion. This is the best gift that he could receive from his father that he had hardly known. So he bowed, he kissed the letter, and then he ran over to his imam, knowing now that his last wish was granted. And then when before the imam even knew what was happening, when he saw that handwriting, he knew that this was from his brother, and he burst out into tears, and then he started reading the letter. "My beloved Hussein, when this letter will be read by you, you'll be surrounded by sorrow on all sides, with dead bodies of your near and dear ones spread all around you. And I won't be there to lay down my life for you, Hussein. But I'm leaving behind for you my Qasim. He will be my deputy. He will be my representative. He said, I ask you, do not reject my qasim. In the name of the love that I have for you, in the name of the love that you have for me, I beg you, please, let my qasim go forth and die in your defense. My dear brother, in spirit, I am with you, and I'm watching your heroic sacrifices from paradise, and I'm sharing in your pain. Hussein tried to hold himself back from tears, but of course he couldn't do so. And he burst out into tears, and he hugged his beloved nephew, Qasim. And then he said, dear child, your father's wishes, I regard them as commands from me, for he was my imam. This leaves me no other alternative. Go on, Qasim, as your father wished. And if I'm supposed to watch you die on the battlefield, this has to be the will of Allah. And now, brothers and sisters, Qasim is happy. Other people who feel like they're about to die have a sadness on their face, but not this Qasim, not this mu'min, not this family member of Ali, not this family member of Fatima, not this descendant of Muhammad, not this descendant of Hassan, not this nephew of Hussein. So he runs out to battle, a 14-year-old. Remember this, brothers and sisters. And before he goes, the Imam takes the turban of his father, Imam Hassan, and he wraps it around his head. He kisses him on the forehead one last time, and he sends him off to battle. And when the enemy saw him, they said, this is not a human coming, this is like the moon coming towards us. And then Qasim started reciting poetry like a warrior. He said, إِن تُقُرْنِي فَأَنَا عَبْنُ الْحَسَنِ سِبْتِ النَّبِيِّ الْمُصْطَفَى الْمُتَّمَنِ هَذَا حُسَيْنُ كَلَا سِيرِ الْمُتَهَّنِ بَيْنَا أُنَاسٍ لَحْسُقُوا سَوَابُ الْمُزَنِ. If you don't know me, I am the son of Hassan, who is the son of the distinguished Holy Prophet. This is Hussein, he's a prisoner among this group, and may Allah deprive you from rain from the sky. He charged the battlefield. Again, he was only 14, but he came at them like he was an adult, like he was a true warrior of Islam. 35 people they say that he killed. And when the enemies saw this, they said, no longer can we see that this fighting goes on anymore, we have to end this. So one of these cowards came out, and they went behind him secretly, and they struck him in the back. They struck him in the back of the head with a sword, and then Qasim fell. He fell to the ground with his face, and he cried, "Ya Amma, Ya, oh my uncle!" And then his uncle Hussein came running to him, and he ran to his uncle like a, he ran to his nephew like a falcon moves, and he came and he destroyed Qasim's killer. And then once this happened, they tried to rescue the killer of Qasim. And even then, this is the curse of what of people that try to kill the family of the Ahlul Bayt. When these Mab'oon, when these soldiers of Yazid try to get the pick up this killer's body, they trample over him. And this was his destiny. And then the Imam came near the head of Qasim. And he had said, the Qasim was already gone. And he said, how much hard is it for me, your uncle, that you called for me for help, but I couldn't do anything. And even if I could do something, it couldn't help you in the least, because Allah has decreed you to go to heaven right away. And then he made his last dua, Ya Allah, may Allah deprive blessings away from this group of his children. He took Qasim, and he took him back to his camp. And all the women, of course, began to cry. And one of our narrators tell us that he looked at the feet of the youth, and he saw that while they were pulling him, he said, where are we taking him? And they placed him near the body of his family. And as everybody cried, someone had recited some poetry, and his mother was standing. And then the Imam recited his following, his last verse, and he said, they are lying away, far away from their homes and native lands, while the wild beasts of the plains are mourning upon them. How come the eyes don't shed tears upon this group, whose bodies have been torn apart by enemy swords, the beautiful moons whose shining have been silenced, and the dust of plain has changed their beautiful bodies? This was the status of the youth of Karbala. Allah la'anahu Allah ala qawm al-zalimeen. وَسَيَعْنَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيُّمُ الْقَلَبِينَ يَنْقَلَبُونَ إِنَّ لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّ عَلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ وَظَنْ بِقَضَائِهِ وَتَسْتَعْمَنْ بِعَمَرِهِ.